Brito, my partner and I talk about the business of sports with all kinds of interesting folks from the business. Joe, good to be back with you.
And it's summer in New York, Tom, almost anyway.
Summer in New York. We haven't been together for a show in it seems like a month or so.
But people wouldn't know by listening if you listen in order.
Well, that's true. Yeah, and we find ourselves intrigued by a topic we're going to get back into today because it still remains a fascinating part of this business, and that is the subject of sports betting and sports gambling. We have an expert in the house today to talk about that.
Make a simple bet. That's all we want to do is make a simple bet.
Everybody just wants, at the end of the day, you just want to make a simple bet, and we're going to talk about that. So we've got a sports industry veteran here, someone Joe and I have known for a while, and we're really pleased to welcome Stephen Master to the show. Stephen,
thank you.
Good to have you.
Guys, for having me. It's great to be here.
For those who don't know Stephen, you may recognize the name from Nielsen, where he spent a bunch of years prior to his current job, which is with Simple Bet.
Yes.
Sports gambling, etc., which we're going to talk about, where he's the chief commercial officer. But he also had stints in his past at the National Football League and Octagon, among others. And he's a Midwestern college guy with a huge network around his college and graduate school experiences at Michigan and Northwestern. Seems like they're everywhere in this business.
Mm-hmm. Especially those Michigan folk, right?
Yes. So, good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Our pleasure. And we want to get into the subject of sports betting and gambling. There's some big breaking news in that world right now that we're going to talk about. There's some big trends, challenges for the business we want to talk about. But it's really interesting how you have kind of evolved into being a thought leader and executive in this space. So let's do a little backstory and then tell us how you kind of got into this part of the business.
Yeah, no, my career in sports really started during business school. As you mentioned, I went to Michigan undergrad, worked in more traditional business school undergraduate path, working in finance, and then went back to grad school at Northwestern. And in between years of Northwestern, between my first and second year, I decided I wanted to go a little bit more non-traditional and do something in the sports and entertainment space. So I flew out to LA, and that was the time well before LinkedIn and social media and even really email, and just used a phone and just started calling anyone who went to Northwestern or Michigan and tried to set up coffees.
The alumni network.
And I flew out to LA, slept on a buddy's couch for about a week, and went to the same coffee shop in Brentwood about 12 times that week, and ended up fortunate enough to get an internship at the Walt Disney Company that summer. And that was the summer of 1995, so over 20 years ago. And the interesting thing was, at the time, they were just in the process of buying ESPN. Mm. So they were trying to figure out sports and sports licensing, and the woman who hired me, who I'm still very close with, said, I don't know anything about this space, and you seem like you'd be great. Maybe you could help me navigate and figure it out. So that was really my break into the business.
Who was that?
Her name was Sharon Markowitz, and she'd gone to Harvard Business School and was more traditional, and she'd done traditional licensing, but she had licensed The Lion King and The Little Mermaid and Pocahontas and the more traditional Disney films, and here they were acquiring ESPN, and she didn't know anything about the sports space. Not that I had so much experience in it either.
It's not like you had it.
I showed an interest and passion for it, and it just kind of rolled from there. So I had that internship that summer in between years of business school, continued to work for her that whole full second year at business school at Northwestern. And then after business school, got an opportunity. At the time, the MBA joked nothing but attorneys, but they started to hire MBAs at that point in the mid-90s. So I was part of that first kind of class, second class, where they started hiring MBAs and bringing on MBAs from some of the top programs. And I got slotted into a role in MBA International. So working to help build the MBA brand globally. So it was a blast as a first job right out of business school, traveling all over the world. And then, as many of the listeners know, in 1992 was the first Dream Team. 1996, which is when I graduated from business school, was the Summer Games in Atlanta. So it was really just starting to pick up steam in terms of building the international presence it is now with the NBA Finals in Toronto. It's just an incredible number of players from all over the world, and probably many of them were inspired by the work we did 20 plus years ago, building that NBA brand globally. So I spent 4 years at the NBA.
Who was running international at the time?
So it was a guy by the name of Paul Zilk was running it, and then Paul and Heidi Uberoff running it. Heidi was on the media side, Paul was kind of on the commercial, non-media side, licensing, things like that. And interestingly enough, one of the big strategies that we had that I thought was really thoughtful was, gaming, right? And not, what I mean by that was not betting, but now esports is everywhere, but video games. And so one of the ways that we thought made sense to build the global NBA brand was through video game tournaments in different places. So we would set up these huge video game tournaments in places like Japan, and it was really pre-China. We weren't doing that much in China at that point, but in Brazil, in European, key European, Western European markets.
Was that the beginning of NBA 2K or whatever?
Yeah, at that point we had seven or eight licensees.
Yeah, a lot of licensees in
the
NBA.
EA and Konami and Sega, and we had all these licensees, and we said, well, most of the games were on, particularly in Europe, were on the middle of the night, so they couldn't really watch them. At that point, there wasn't a ton of distribution for NBA games, at least live and at odd times. So we felt that video games was a great way for them to not just to get to know the NBA, but the players, the teams, and really get to know the sport. So it was way ahead of its time. It was before esports was even a thing, but NBA really kind of built that international presence through video games.
Yeah. Well, we've heard that from students here from other countries who didn't get, were not watching traditional feeds of the broadcasts, but they got to know the sport and the players through the video games. A bunch of examples I've heard through the years from Madden especially, which was incredibly popular. Yep. NBA is right behind it.
Yeah, so that was
a
big
piece. You were a visionary.
I don't know about that, but that was one of the things that we did, and Adam was much lower down than Silver, but he was very much involved in a lot of the driving of that strategy. So after the NBA, I left and was in the agency world and worked at a couple of agencies and had a long stint or 4-year stint at the Octagon agency, where we were working in corporate consulting. And then from there, I went to the NFL and was at the NFL in the sponsorship group. And then in 2009, about almost 10 years ago, took a job at Nielsen TV ratings company, amongst other things that they do, to run the sports group. And at the time, it was really a very small group. They didn't really have a lot going on in sports. They maybe just sold a few Excel spreadsheets of television ratings to some of the leagues. But what we did was, we felt we had just some great data, some great analytics, some great information. And we really kind of felt that kind of stealing something from Billy Beane and the whole Moneyball idea was they had analytics. We decided we would have fanalytics. So it was a term that I made up and said, hey, we've got so much great data on media consumption and the ways people are engaging with content, both on audio, in TV, on digital, on social, across every different channel. We're measuring all that. We also have great information around the consumption of what people were purchasing, whether that be through the grocery store scanner information or relationships we had with some of these companies that we understood with credit card purchases. So we could know if Mets fans were more likely to fly Delta or JetBlue, or if Yankee fans drove Toyota versus Ford, and we could tie that to sponsorship. So we did some really, really interesting things to understand fans, and we called it fanalytics. We had the deepest understanding of fans and fan behavior, both kind of what they watch and what they buy. And that was really the whole model, is understanding fan behavior, and we started to really broaden out from just kind of Excel spreadsheets with TV ratings, and we created the first kind of year in sports media report 9 or 10 years ago.
That's right. Yeah.
And that became a really kind of really, I think, a really industry standard for kind of something that people look forward to at the end of every year, to kind of a year back look at sports and fan consumption and fan behavior. So that was really what we did at Nielsen, and we kind of built a pretty sizable business from a revenue and personnel standpoint, and that was a lot of fun. And recently left there in fall of 18 and took on a role in the sports betting space. I decided that I saw, like everybody else, that there was a real big opportunity here with the change in law with PASPA, exactly about 13 months ago, and had done some work really for some of the betting operators as leading up to PASPA, understanding if someone plays fantasy or gambles or does things like that, what was their consumption in media? How many more games did they watch? How many minutes did they spend with a sport, if those who were just avid fans who didn't gamble? So I had done some work on the edges around that.
Had you done something on behalf of Nielsen a year or two before?
Yeah,
that?
No, we...
Something specific.
At Nielsen, we did about 4 or 5 different studies for the American Gaming Association. So the American Gaming Association is a lobby group based in Washington, D.C., and they represent all the interests of the casino operators throughout the country. and they sports betting became on their radar. Really, Joe and I have talked about this with the Adam Silver op-ed in New York Times
yep.
in 2014, December 2014. And the AGA said, well, this was an issue we've never really, our members have really given much thought to or really cared about. But with the Adam Silver kind of op-ed, that was the first time a major commissioner had said, well, maybe yeah. we will soften our stance and maybe there is a way mm-hmm. to get it forward on this. So the AGA engaged Nielsen and we did a number of different studies really in this space. So I kind of got smart on it really quickly through those studies.
So what did you see back then? Because you're really one of the first guys who probably was thinking about it a little bit more in a more sophisticated way than others who weren't as close to it. What did you see that was coming in terms of how it was going to progress? Because 5 years ago is a long time. PASPA wasn't until 4 years after that.
Right.
So what were you seeing based on the data and the reports you were doing? About the tsunami that was...
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that we really wanted to do and that the AGA wanted to prove was to go to the sports league to show them the opportunity that exists if gambling was going to be legal,
right?
In terms of dollars and cents, because they knew the casinos understood dollars and cents better than anyone.
And the leagues, yeah.
Right, and the leagues. The leagues and the owners, I mean, especially the ownership groups. So what the first study that we did was focused on the NFL season. We took the 2015 NFL season, so it's 4 years ago now, but we said, let's look at our Nielsen panel and TV. And this wasn't just a survey that we did where we asked people that they watched more or less. We usually literally used the Nielsen panel and we looked at the entire season. We looked at their viewership habits over an entire season. So it wasn't just talking to 50 people and are you going to watch more because you gamble, right? It was a really, really thoughtful, strategic, comprehensive study using the Nielsen panel. And we looked at a number of people in the panel, and we looked at anyone who was part of it was avid NFL fans, and half of the avid NFL fans didn't gamble or play fantasy or do any of that stuff. They just were avid NFL fans, and they liked to watch their NFL. And the other half played fantasy, gambled either in Nevada or otherwise, many offshore books. And we looked at their viewership over the course of the season. And what was interesting was the avid NFL fans watched about 15.9 games a season, which is like one a weekend, which makes sense. Maybe they watched their home team. The other group watched 37 or 38 games a season. So it wasn't like 10% more. It was like 2.5 times as much. So that was a really compelling study. The AGA got a lot of press around that. And of course, we went to we set up meetings with all the TV networks. We set up meetings with all the TV our executives, and we also went to all the leagues and said, hey, look at this study that we did. This is a really big opportunity if we can figure out a way to move this forward. So that was the first really comprehensive landmark study we did, and then we did another one to kind of looking at figuring out a financial model, what it would look like if we could make gaming was going to be legal, sports betting was going to be legal, it was going to be legal and accessible to 100 million people, and also pretty frictionless, right? Mobile, we made a bunch of assumptions in our model, but the model came back that there was going to be many, many billions of dollars made.
So that's really interesting. So that study was done in 15, released, I suppose, in 16?
Yes.
After the season,
The TV one was done in 16.
But at that moment in time, notwithstanding Adam's editorial from 14, most of the commissioners publicly were still expressing doubt or were just flat out dismissive about sports gambling.
And some were even suing the state of New Jersey.
Well, right, then there was the New Jersey case in the midst of that. So how do you square that?
They were saying that publicly, but behind the scenes, they all had put together committees and they were working really closely.
Right.
And initially, it was interesting, I was working very closely with the American Gaming Association as a strategic advisor. So they formed this group called the Sports Betting Task Force Board. And Sports Betting Task Force Board consisted of all the casinos and then all the, once the British sports folks even saw that what was going on, they all kind of wanted to join the American Gaming Association Sports Betting Task Force Board, and they all came over. And initially, you name it, the leagues and the networks were very, very hesitant. And they were all clients of Nielsen, so I knew them all. But they were like, we're not really ready to just talk about gambling. And ESPN were like, well, we can't really meet with you. We don't even want the AGA in the office. And then slowly, I'd email them the study, and they said, why don't you come in? Why don't you come in and present the study? So it went from not even allowing us to taking a meeting with us to all of a sudden, not only were they taking meetings, they said, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this research project, that research project? And they were getting us more work. Mm-hmm. So it went from not even opening the door. By 2017, 2 years after the first study, they were commissioning more work from Nielsen specific to their sport.
I mean, and so there was the commissioning of the work to further their business objectives while they were processing the legal strategy vis-a-vis the state, because federal, it didn't appear that federal was going to be possible.
Right.
In light of the federal politics, but that was at what point? In other words, at what point did the state by state thing become the reality?
Once the Supreme Court decided to take the case, I think that was 17. Okay. When they decided to take the case, everyone realized that, hey, this is a really real possibility that this could happen even sooner than we thought.
Yeah.
So once the Supreme Court made the decision to take the case, every single, I'm not joking, every single league and every single network called me and said, I want you and Sarah to come back in and explain this to us. I mean, mm-hmm. Sarah Slane is from the American Gaming Association. Right. So we literally did a roadshow and went to every media company and literally walked them through all the different scenarios, potential with the Supreme Court hearing the case, because obviously they did a lot of homework, and how it would look and how it could potentially play out. And they really wanted to get smart on it. And then at the same time, as much as they were kind of publicly against it, they were very much working on strategies and sponsorship strategies and media strategies and thinking about all the things they can do to gear up for the possibility that it could become legal.
Can we talk about, for a second, the thorny issue of royalties or integrity fees, as they are sometimes called, or they're technically different things, I suppose, but oftentimes they're used interchangeably. It's obviously controversial, hasn't been effective so far, correct me if I'm wrong. So
right. So
here we are in June of 19, we have 11 states. There are no integrity fees or royalties being paid. Is that
in statute? There actually is integrity fees being paid or royalties being paid. It's just not in statute, right? So
okay,
what the leagues wanted was they wanted every state to have it. So in their legislation, it said that, and the NBA went really, really high with that 1%, which they knew would never happen, because the 1% of handle is like 25% of profit. So that was never going to fly, but they wanted to start high, and then they said, well, we'll come down to 0.25% of handle. So then it didn't sound so bad. Like, well, we've cut our ass by 25, you know, 75%. So they wanted it in the legislation saying that it was mandated that anyone that did business with the league would be paying them a royalty. But what the operators wanted was they wanted it to be in commercial contracts. They didn't want it in mandated by the state. They wanted, if they were going to do a deal with the NBA, then if MGM wanted to do a deal with the NBA, and the NBA said, hey, if you're going to do a deal with us, like Nike pays us a license fee, you're going to pay us a license fee, MGM. Mm-hmm. But that was part of a private agreement. It wasn't part of the public legislation.
I see. Okay.
So that was the sticking point.
So go ahead, Joe.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. No, so one follow-up question on that. So how many of the, I don't know if this is publicly free information, how many of the leagues have those kinds of relationships with the operators?
Well, the NBA has, I think, in the U.S. about 4 different partners right now.
NHL has a bunch as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, NHL has a bunch, but the NHL is not charging licensing fees, so they've been more, they've been much more open to just trying to expand gambling and keep it frictionless. The NBA and MLB are charging, you know, the world, they've been more kind of banded together, as was the PGA Tour. So the Tour, the NBA, and the MLB were all together, and they were insisting on 0.25%. So the NBA has a deal with Stars, has a deal with MGM, and has a deal with FanDuel, has a deal with DraftKings. So all 4 of those, in their contracts, they pay a royalty or a license fee, or whatever you want to call it, integrity fee. It doesn't matter. A percentage of those bets is going back to the NBA because of the deals that they've structured, you know, from a sponsorship perspective. But it's not in statute. MLB, as of right now, as of this, we record this podcast, there's only one deal, and that's with MGM. And MGM has made it, they've felt that it was worth it to be as a sponsor to pay whatever percentage that they mandated 0.25%.
Do the leagues still hope to get it in statute at some point with the states?
As
the other 39 states think about this, or 40?
They hope so, but it seems like it's a losing battle.
Yeah.
And they, at this point, they're not giving up. They're still very much going to educate state legislators and telling them why they deserve it and need it. But so far, no one has bought that argument. And in fact, the American Gaming Association commissioned a study with Nielsen to show, to go the other on the other side of it, to, on behalf of their members, to say how much money the leagues stand to make because of sports gambling, that they don't need this in statute. You're already making billionaires even richer by putting this statute in place. And if they want to do it commercially, then it's up to the casinos and they have the flexibility to either do it or not do it, but they don't want to be told what to do by the state for something that they feel like they shouldn't be paying for.
So there's a lot of strange bedfellows that are developing in terms of relationships in this business. Talk about the ecosystem of the operators, the leagues, the media companies, some of whom have gotten in or want to get in, the fantasy sports companies, you just named two of them, the big ones, FanDuel and DraftKings, vis-a-vis kind of the actual reality of use cases. So the use cases, I'm either going to go to New Jersey and bet in person, or I'm going to be in a facility, or I'm going to be using a mobile application. But mobile is not widely available yet for much of these states, right?
That's true. In New Jersey, it is. And in New
right.
Jersey, they have quickly shown that that model has to be part of it. Mobile
right.
is, you know, there's some of these other states that were slower to adopt mobile, like Pennsylvania, like Rhode Island, they're disappointed in the tax revenues that they're collecting. Well, meanwhile, they don't have mobile, or Pennsylvania's going to have mobile now, but they didn't initially. Right, and the reason is, if you look at New Jersey as the, you know, the best case example, in a very, very short time, once the mobile apps were up and running, 80% of handle is done through mobile, you know, mobile
right.
devices.
Mm-hmm.
So, while people like to still go into a casino or sports book and watch a game and bet there, the majority of people still like to do it from their couch while they're watching a game
mm-hmm.
or at a bar where it's,
yeah.
there's no sports betting, and unless the other states make mobile as part of it, they're not going to see the tax revenues they hope they would. Mm-hmm. Illinois just passed over this weekend, and mobile is definitely a part of it. So getting to your other question about all the different players in fantasy
yeah.
and daily fantasy in particular, FanDuel and DraftKings spent in the neighborhood of $1 billion collectively on marketing, and that marketing certainly gave them first mover advantage in terms of having brand recognition.
You mean it's for the daily fantasy?
Yeah, and also for real live betting, right?
Right.
So they had significant databases,
right.
and it's not an easy thing to get someone to place a bet when it hasn't been legal. But if you've got a database of many millions of people who have played daily fantasy, the conversion isn't quite as difficult. Right?
Right. I mean, ostensibly, like the idea being, I'm an example, I'm a FanDuel customer, but I live in Connecticut, so I cannot bet on my FanDuel app.
Right.
If I were to go over the George Washington Bridge, I can bet on the FanDuel app.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so FanDuel and DraftKings have gotten way out in front, and more established casinos, one, they've been kind of slower to come up with robust mobile sites. FanDuel and DraftKings have somewhere in the 90%+ market share on mobile, just amongst the two of them, which is significant.
Right, but then again, they don't have the license in every state.
Right, so they've
been... So talk about that.
So in New Jersey, they've gotten it because New Jersey was very, very liberal in terms of allowing licensed operators who are land-based casinos to get skins. And what the skin means is they have the ability to... give the right of that sports book to someone else. So if I'm a land-based casino and I'm the Hard Rock Casino, or I'm the casino in near the Meadowlands, I have the ability to go and give that right to William Hill, to FanDuel, to DraftKings.
Mm.
And so they were able to get into the business relatively quickly. And if you look at this, we just mentioned Illinois before, if you look at the state of Illinois, they were very, very kind to the kind of hometown. They get home field advantage, if you will.
Mm.
They said the folks who have land-based casinos get a bit of a head start. So they are able to have the 18 months without really competition from on the mobile perspective, specifically FanDuel and DraftKings, who have some pretty big brand recognition already. So they can't get into that business for a minimum of 18 months. And some of the established players, Rush Street Gaming is really well known, based in Chicago, has a bunch of casinos there. Assuming they come out with a mobile app, they are going to be the first and one of the only ones available in the state of Illinois. So if they have a really effective and good mobile app, they're going to have a couple year head start over, you know, whoever anyone else can get into the business.
Wow, God, it's crazy.
So let's talk a little bit about kind of where you are now, the idea of Simple Bet, how it's different, and then, you know, even before we do that, give everybody the kind of perspective of, from on a mobile device, how much gambling outside the United States is done on a mobile device versus going into a kiosk or a betting parlor.
Yeah, so if you use the UK as an example, the UK is probably the most developed betting market in the world. It's pretty significant. And if you go and walk around London, they have William Hill, Ladbrokes. They're on just about every major street corner. You feel like it's like Starbucks here in New York City. They have just about every street corner in the down central London, there is a kind of sports book. And they've been around forever, and it's always been like that. And there's still many of exist. I don't feel like many of them have been shut down, at least yet. But younger folks, 35 and under, especially, came through in all the Nielsen research, they just prefer, they're mobile natives. They just prefer to do things on their phone. They do not want to go into a betting shop and place a bet like the old-fashioned way. They want to do it on their phone. So very, very quickly, since everyone's got an iPhone and or Android and the mobile apps have become much more robust and better, 75 to 80% of all bets in the UK now are done via a mobile phone. Wow. And of those, and we'll get to this, but 70% of all handle, whether it be while you're sitting in a sports book and kind of watching a game and betting or on your phone, is what they call in-play betting. So bets placed in a game after the game has started. In the US, that didn't really exist. So you'd walk into a casino in Nevada, where it was the only place that was truly legal, and you bet on the Cowboys playing the Bears, and there was a line of over-under, and there was a line of who was going to win the game, right? And you bet before the game, and that was it. But in-play has really only become a thing since, I want to say, 5 or 6 years ago, and it's become enormous. And 70% of all bets in the UK are after the whistle has blown to start the game.
Interesting. Yeah. So that's a good segue into talking about Simple Bet, I think, right?
It is.
So go for it.
So Simple Bet is really driven by the fact that there's really been very little innovation and really very little investment in this country, in the U.S., in sports betting in general, because of the fact it was only really legal in Nevada, and it was a very small base, and Nevada wasn't really that interested in innovation. And if you look at the mobile apps that even were available in Nevada, they really were a very, very poor user experience. And no one really cared. People were there. They were there to the sports books. They were there for March Madness. They were there for the Super Bowl. The sports book, they wanted to just feel the action. It was almost like being at the game because they had some money on it, and it was a bunch of fans and screaming and yelling and all that. But there wasn't really a whole lot of innovation. With the change in law with PASPA in exactly a year ago, 13 months ago, all of a sudden there became a flood of real interest in, okay, how do we invest? How do we make the sports betting experience a lot better? And that's really when that was Simple Bet was started. And that they got the kind of the first seed money was right around April of May of 2018, and started building out the team and raising money, and the first serious raise was in October of 2018. So I started building out a team. I joined them as the chief commercial officer in September, October of 18. And the premise of Simple Bet was, like you said, making betting simpler, making betting more intuitive, making betting easier, but also making it different, right? A different experience for the fans. So going to baseball, and Joe and I have talked about this before, now baseball betting is just complicated, right? It's minus 120. What does that even mean? The Reds are playing the Cubs. You don't even know what that means. And most, even sophisticated bettors, haven't really historically bet a lot on baseball. But baseball lends itself very, very well to in-play betting. And the idea is, we're not at the point where you're going to bet on every pitch at this point, but you could bet on every at bat, right? So you could be watching the game and there could be 70 to 80 at bats in a game, and each one of those is an independent occurrence, and you can bet on the outcome of that independent occurrence. And with everything that all the research MLB's done, all the research that we've seen is people, particularly fans in the US, they love players. They love the outcome and performance of players because they've grown up with fantasy. So this is fantasy sports kind of on steroids, if you will, right? You don't have to wait to the end of the game and see how many hits and strikeouts a pitcher's got. You could bet on the outcome of a single at bat. You could bet on the pitcher and whether or not they're going to get a strikeout or they're going to get an out or give up a hit, and what's the outcome of the at bat. So that's some of the things that we're thinking about and working really closely with MLB and working really closely with others in the ecosystem, the data companies and whatnot, to be able to develop probabilities for each at bat. The big innovation is sports has generally been traded manually, and you can't trade, and you know, you have all these traders and they kind of come up with odds pre-match, and maybe there's some fluctuation during the game, but it's impossible to use traders to be able to create probabilities and odds of every single at bat across 15 MLB games in one night. It's just not possible. You need to use things like machine learning, you need to use things like artificial intelligence, you need to use things like really sophisticated algorithms, automated algorithmic pricing systems to be able to price an at-bat as someone walks in, depending on the situation. Aaron judges what's the weather like, who's pitching, is the lefty, righty, is that like, they have the shift on with Aaron Judge of this team, to, you know, how many people are on base, is the wind blowing in or out, you know, because he typically hits to left field versus right field, right? So there's all these factors, and we factor all of that in to be able to create probabilities for what Aaron Judge is going to do at that at-bat.
And where are you getting the data from?
So all the historical data, we worked very closely with MLB. MLB gave us every single pitch and every at-bat since 2001. So we had about 18 years of data that a really, really smart team was able to analyze and kind of create some really sophisticated modeling around to see what signals drove outcomes, right? And they kind of tinker with the model, and they spent many months with looking at all that data to come up with these algorithms. So that was initially how they built the models. Going forward, we're working with the official MLB data partners. So there's two of them right now, Sport Radar and the Perform Group. So we're working really closely with both of those groups to get the data in real time. So after every single pitch, we get a kind of ping. Our system gets a ping, and we're able to monitor every pitch, every at bat, and all that. And then we use that in real time to be able to, our models adjust to be able to create probabilities, which we sell those to sports books.
And so for people who don't know, the way that for years people have gotten around using the official data was literally have people sitting in the stands either phoning in or charting pitches or sending them on their phone. What's the value of having the official data that fast for the audience that you're trying to go after?
Well, you need it because even though an at bat could take 10 seconds if he hits the first pitch, or it could take a minute if they foul off and it becomes a long count, you if you're going to get a bet in, it's got to be while they're on the on deck circle, right? So you have very little time. If there's any, you know, latency, if there's 8 to 10 seconds of latency, the person could already be in the batter's box and swung at the first pitch, and then you're getting the TV feed and you already know what happened, so you can bet that.
I think this actually is a moment in time where app performance finally is realized. It's really understood as the most, that's coming too, but it's all, you said the words before, it's user experience.
Yep.
And in this realm of sports content, you can't afford not to have perfect technology. It'll screw up the whole thing.
Right, because the people...
You can screw up daily fantasy, you can screw up streaming, you can't screw this up.
There'll be huge arbitrage opportunities for bettors, and people are going to say, wow, there's a 10 second delay.
Right.
I already know what happened.
Right.
Right? Because I'm in the stands. So there is definitely, it's critical that by the way, you know, Simple Bets algorithms, in literally less than microseconds, they're recalculating odds as a player steps up to the plate.
Steven, to be clear, Simple Bet is a technology that's been developed the last year and a half or so. That will be essentially a platform, tech platform, or tech solution. You'll bring to the direct consumer players such as MLB, correct? You're not going to be a direct consumer app. I'm not going to have a simple bet app on my phone.
Exactly. Yeah. We really are a B2B company.
So how would I use it as a baseball, when this does come into the market, how would I use it as a baseball bettor?
So we'll sell it into an MGM, because right now MGM, like right. I said, is the only authorized MLB partner. But hopefully MLB has more partners in the very near term. If FanDuel and DraftKings, you know, pay the royalties, whatever MLB wants, they'll be licensed, authorized baseball partners, betting partners, casino partners, and they'll be able to.
So your tech would be baked into those apps.
Exactly. So if you're on DraftKings,
the attribution of SimpleBet, like, do you care about the brand development of SimpleBet?
At some point, we will.
Like
at this
Intel
point,
Intel inside SimpleBet inside.
We'll probably, we'll hopefully get there if we get a smart PR guy like Joe.
And we need a big ping.
That'd
be audio branding.
We will get there. We will get there soon enough. At this point, we're just trying to get, because it's so new and it's really innovative technology. No one's ever really priced every at bat. Right now, we just want to get people knowing that it even exists.
Will you have it for football season 19?
Yes, we're working closely with the NFL, and we have secured a bunch of historical data for the last five seasons, and we're doing the modeling right now.
Well, I got one or two more questions.
Go ahead.
Do you believe, taking off your SimpleBet hat, thinking, going back to more of your advisory thing and your Nielsen view of the world, will this be the savior, or one of the saviors that this industry seems to be counting on to stem the losses of younger fans as they grow up?
Yeah, savior's that's a big term.
That's dramatic.
The savior, but it'll certainly help. All the work that we've done and all the studies that we've done through Nielsen, and that was commissioned by both the American Gaming Association and, by the way, by some leagues and networks, showed that the person who typically, the profile of someone who typically played daily fantasy or just gambled either in Nevada or illegally, skewed younger, right? So the average age, you're putting my Nielsen hat in a second, of an MLB viewer is high 50s-ish, right? 58 to 60 even, right? The person who is typically a bettor, particularly on a mobile app, is generally well under 40. Mm-hmm. Closer to 35. Mm-hmm. So if they're watching more and they're more engaged, and that's certainly going to help drive ratings. And it doesn't take a ton of people playing to drive ratings. If a typical NBA game on a Tuesday on TNT gets 3 million viewers, if only 300,000 people watch that game more, or watch that game because they've got something skin in it and they're watching it because they've got some money on it, or somehow, that's a pretty big ratings bump, right?
Yeah.
300,000 doesn't seem like a lot, but that's 10%.
Mm-hmm.
That's a significant ratings bump, and that 300,000 people is not that many.
Right.
If you think about a Tuesday night TNT game for the NBA.
So make one prediction, 10 years from now, sports gambling is humming along in the US. We haven't gone out of business. And it's still state by state. I mean, federal, I suppose, is a possibility in the future. What sports will be most? What's going to be the pecking order of sports where most gambling is occurring?
Well,
10 years from now.
10 years from now, that puts us in 2029. You hope that at close to 40 states probably are legal by then. There'll always be some that won't be. Utah probably won't be, and there'll be others. But let's just say
10 years just to get to 40.
Yeah, so at least 40. I mean, hopefully at least 40 by then, maybe more. But so the majority of the country will have access to legalized sports betting. Hopefully by then it'll all be mobile. Hopefully by then it'll be 5G.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the way that people will consume it will be different. They don't necessarily need to watch it on television. There'll be a gambling feed that you'll be able to watch. And so I don't know how much that it'll drive necessarily TV ratings, but it'll drive consumption of the sport. So I think it'll just look different.
But what sports will get the most action 10 years from now? In your opinion, I know this is just your opinion.
I would think the NFL football really is just it's the scarcity of the games and just the ability not only to sit on your couch on a Saturday for college football and a Sunday for NFL and be able to sit there and not only bet on the outcome of the games, but also that every drive is a really, really compelling and fun thing, right? There's in baseball, there's so many games. There's games every day. There's 15 games every day. Mm. On a Saturday, there's a lot of games in college, but still, let's say you watch 10 different games. And if you can bet on not only the outcome, but you can bet on the outcome of every drive, that's a fun way to engage and watch a game. And the same thing on Sunday.
All right, so football number one.
Yes.
Who's 2, 3, and 4? And again, this answer, I'd love this answer to be kind of thinking about, you know, with your Nielsen hat on and your gaming industry hat on.
Right. I think number two is probably the NBA just because of the global nature of it. It's just, they're so social and they're so far ahead. Tom and I were just talking about this before. They're so far ahead from a social media perspective.
And tech.
And a tech perspective. So if they are tweeting out different things and you're able to say, hey, there's 5 minutes left in the game, and Adam's already said that you can just buy the last 2 minutes of a basketball game.
Yep.
Hey, there's 2 minutes left in the game. How many points is LeBron going to score in the last 2 minutes? I don't think he'll be playing in 10 years, but LeBron Jr.
His son will be.
How many points is that person going to, Zion Williamson, how many points is he going to score in the last 2 minutes? 0 to 4, 5 to 10, or 10 plus
That's
in the
nice
last 2 minutes, right? A nice simple bet. It's fun. It's a fun way to watch that last 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think NBA, just because it's so global and it's so popular and also so smart when it comes from a social media perspective. So on Twitter, when you're watching the game, on your feed, it'd be like, click here to bet on the outcome of the last 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Think it ever could be somehow embedded into Twitter?
Well, absolutely. We've met with Twitter. We've talked to Twitter about it. At SimpleBet, they're not there yet.
Yeah.
I think they want a few more states, but we are talking to the leagues and we're talking to some of these social media companies, and we're thinking about ways. Twitter's really the best for it because of the real time nature.
And they already have it because they've got the polling mechanism already built in.
Yes,
that's what I mean. And you think about the real time nature of it and how they have very little latency to begin with. It's only going to get better.
Yeah.
Well, before we go to the final wrap up,
sure.
You don't have to expound, but just sports 3 and 4, 10 years from now for betting action.
Doesn't have to be team sports either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hint, hint.
I'll give you some choices. Esports, soccer.
I think golf is going to be really is great for it because of the fact, again, there's the idea of each hole is an independent occurrence, right?
Stopping
and
starting.
All these players, and there's 100 players to start, 100 plus players to start on a Thursday, and you could bet on every player on every hole. The problem is the technology is not there yet. So I know IMG has made a huge investment along with the PGA Tour and a bunch of other golf organizations around the world to make it better. But when you have 5G and you've got Shot Tracker and all the other things, it doesn't matter if the camera is always on Tiger Woods Jr. or whoever is the next Tiger Woods 10 years from now. You'll be able to follow the player that you like best and be able to track them and bet on their outcome of their hole on the 12th hole. So it doesn't matter where the TV screen is.
So our last two questions, which we like to ask everyone, how do you stay smart and up to date with everything? Who do you follow? What do you read? And then, as Thomas said, we've had a lot of students listen to this, or people changing jobs. What's the advice that you give people, either on a job change or just coming into an industry?
So what do I read? I've got to start off with the Joe Favorito weekly newsletter, for sure.
Right.
You know, that's always... And the new look is great, and that's
improved.
Always fun, and he's got great links, and if anyone that's not reading, it's crazy that you don't get the link on the email distribution list, because it's a really, really fun, and it's not just sports. I think you mix in a lot of other interesting things that are around sponsorship, around music, around just around things.
Coffee cups, lots of coffee cups.
Things going on in the business of entertainment, really. So I think that's a good one. And then obviously the mainstay, the Sports Business Journal, the Sports Business Daily, all those things. But it's also really just reading things as I've gotten, obviously, into the gaming space. I get gaming specific newsletters, right? So you just got to get really smart. And I teach at NYU as well. And I always tell my students, you just have to be over prepared when you walk into an interview, when you walk into a meeting. And there's no reason not to know everything about that person you're going to meet with, where they went to college, every place they've worked, how many kids they have, probably you can figure out what their dog's name is. I mean, you can figure out just about anything because it's all available. And if you're not doing your homework when you walk into a meeting, it's shame on you, because you have the ability now at your fingertips to pretty much have all the information you need when you walk into a meeting. So in terms of just reading, just continuing to, particularly if you have a specific niche, whether it's media, whether it's gaming, whether it's esports, there's specific newsletters to each one of those verticals, and you should not only read the sports business daily and the journals, you got to read those things as well.
Stephen, quickly, can you recommend one or two for sports gaming for people who are interested in this part of the business, they're just getting into it?
ERG is a good newsletter. There's two or three really good newsletters that that I read. They seem to have a really good handle on it. There is another one's business. The American Gaming Association has a really pretty robust
and they're
website.
They're pretty active on Twitter too.
And they have all kinds of really good stats and really good things available to folks who seek it out. So, and they, if you sign up, they give you a, kind of a PDF of different things going on in terms of legislation, in terms of new things going on in the gaming space. So it's really just a matter of seeking it out and just getting smart on the topic. And in terms of the question about advice, and I think this is so critical, it's really just building relationships. This business is, you know, the real estate business is built on location, location, location. The sports business is built on relationships, relationships, relationships. And, you know, I'm sure you guys talk about this in your classes all the time, but you can't emphasize that enough. As much as you think you've done building relationships, you could build more, right? Mm-hmm. It's so
and diversify
critical.
Them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it shouldn't be every time you need a job, and it shouldn't be every time you need to close a piece of business,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You just need to get together
Let's make
with
that
people,
list right?
Right? Like, you know, Tom and I, the reason I'm doing this podcast, Tom and I just got together. We just together to right? We just met for a cup of coffee, and we just started chatting and you know, what are you up to? Before that we just had lunch and we had coffee when we were down in North Carolina, Joe and I. It's just a matter of it wasn't anything specific. We were just getting together to shoot the breeze about the industry. And that's really what it's all about. Just shooting the industry. What are you working on? What are you doing? This job at SimpleBet came about because I was talking to a colleague who lives in my town who was the chairman and founder of the company, right? And I was just saying, hey, what kind of things are you working on? He was a client at Nielsen. And it just kind of went from there. So that's how it started. I had no agenda when we went out for beers. And just kind of 4 months later, I'm working for him.
That's a really good perspective. Well, thank you. That was terrific. Mm-hmm.
And where do people get info on SimpleBet? Is there a place they should go to, Twitter feed, website?
Yeah, we have a LinkedIn account, SimpleBet, and our website, simplebet.io. Admittedly, the website's not that robust right now. We just have a bunch of our people there and kind of what we're doing. It hasn't gotten that detailed yet, but we're early days, and we're excited about the launch of our first product around MLB and measuring every at-bat or probabilities every at-bat in the next few weeks, actually.
So that'll be in mid-June for people who aren't following right along when we post this, the beginning of June.
And then what about you, Eddie? Do you want to throw a Twitter handle or anything? Or
no, I'm good. I'm good.
Stay in the background.
Stay in the background. But it's been great, and I think what you guys are doing is fantastic, and I know this is a great program. The conference you did last fall was great, and it seems to be really building and growing, and these guys are the best at networking, so you've got to just continue to do that. Build relationships and network.
All right. Cool. Excellent.
Tom, wrap us up.
Thank you, Stephen. That was terrific. So we've been talking to industry veteran Stephen Master, now of SimpleBet, Chief Commercial Officer, formerly of Nielsen and Octagon and NFL and Michigan and Northwestern, and that's quite a resume. But it was really good perspective. This is a fascinating topic. I'd love to, Joe, have Stephen back maybe 6 months from now. And if we're in 12 states as of tonight, this weekend, Illinois.
Right.
6 months from now, maybe we'll be at 15 or 20. But I think one thing that I've learned in listening to you and following these developments is that the moves being made right now, some of the most interesting strategy that this business has seen in a long time. I mean, if you just leave out the general challenges of digital and things like that, but it really is fascinating to watch the machinations right now, the different parties.
Yeah, I think the Fox Bet one will be really
we should have talked
fascinating,
about
right? So the model was with Sky Bet in the UK, and that was a very favorable outcome for everybody. So it'll be interesting to see how the Fox Bet plays out over the next few
years.
Well,
let's make a date to come back to this in 6 months, and let me get one quick final prediction. So the media companies that have gotten into this are now Fox with Fox Bet, and theScore, just trying to do some kind of betting mechanism, mm-hmm. which I haven't checked out yet. How many more media companies will get in by 6 months from now? No long answer here.
Yeah, it seems like the others are, at this point, are going to sit on the sidelines, particularly ESPN, okay. well, and Turner, and
CBS. So by the NFL
CBS
season, we're kind of where we would be right now.
Yes, all I think so. And talking to all of them, I think that they were going to make the move.
Well, yeah, you would know because you're having all the conversations. Yeah. So you heard it there first, everybody.
yeah.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. That was terrific.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Royce.
Thanks,
good
Tom.
Show. Thanks to the listeners, most importantly. You've been listening to the Cusp Show, a little chat about sports gambling, one of our favorite topics here these days. So we appreciate everybody listening. We'll see you next week.